Good evening, I'm Nick Schifrin. Jeff Bennett and Amna Nawaz are away. On the NewsHour tonight, the U.S. temporarily lifts sanctions on Iran, as Vice President Vance says Tehran will allow U.N. nuclear inspectors back into the country. The United Kingdom's uncertain political future after Keir Starmer succumbs to political pressure and resigns as prime minister. And melting ice, the scientist and his family who've been tracking rapidly melting glaciers for nearly half a century.
This landscape has been shaped by ice. And so to understand the landscape and the ice, you really have to walk across it.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The U.S. temporarily removed oil sanctions on Iran today, creating the potential for an Iranian economic windfall in U.S. dollars as the first round of talks ended in Switzerland. Vice President J.D. Vance led the U.S. delegation, mediated by Qatar and Pakistan. The negotiations come as one of the main sticking points. The war in Lebanon appeared to calm, at least for the day. Liz Landers begins our coverage.
If Iran doesn't live up to their agreement, or if they're not behaving, I will do what I have to do.
President Donald Trump today making a veiled threat to Iran if they don't adhere to the memorandum of understanding that was struck last week.
We're doing very well in terms of negotiating a fair and reasonable deal.
In Switzerland earlier today, Vice President J.D. Vance said talks with Iran are already paving the way for more technical discussions about its nuclear program.
We did exactly what we wanted to do, which is accomplish four things for the American people.
Vance, touting progress, laid out those key points: establishing a mechanism for keeping the Strait of Hormuz open, coordination for the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, a process for the technical negotiations that remain, and an agreement on IAEA inspection of nuclear facilities. But Iran's foreign ministry today denied negotiations on nuclear issues, saying they did not accept any new commitments. Shortly after Vance's comments, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced that his agency would waive sanctions on Iranian oil as part of an interim agreement to end the war. The license authorizes the production, delivery, and sale of Iranian oil into late August. Miad Maliki, a former top sanctions official at the Treasury Department, is now a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. He called the dollar authorization, allowing Iran to get paid in U.S. dollars, a critical detail in the announcement.
Now, as far as cash, I think they have about 67, 68 million barrels of Iranian oil that are within international waters close to China. In Asia, so that becomes available to buyers. And if, you know, at current prices, that is $8 to $9 billion in floating inventory that now becomes available to buyers.
Meanwhile, there was a calm in Lebanon today, with no Israeli strikes reported overnight and into today. But it followed a bloody weekend of Israeli strikes. At a funeral yesterday, a familiar chant, "Death to Israel." Family members gathered to mourn four of the at least two dozen people killed in an Israeli strike on Saturday, including five children. Hours earlier, Israel and Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire, but Israel refused to leave its occupation of southern Lebanon. Hezbollah chief Naim Qassem yesterday adamant in refusing to back down if Israel doesn't.
Israel will not stay in Lebanon, and we will defend ourselves. Any violation we will deal with as we see fit.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today also resolute.
The directive is clear and has not changed. Our fighters in southern Lebanon have full freedom of action to thwart any direct or emerging threat against them.
Just yesterday, Israelis in Tel Aviv lined the streets, bidding farewell to one of the four soldiers killed in southern Lebanon last week. An attendee voiced frustrations over Israel's exclusion from the weekend negotiations.
With the talks of the negotiations between Iran, United States, Israel is out of the question. We are with hands tied behind our back.
Meanwhile, at a natural gas export terminal in Qatar, officials said a blast killed at least 13 people, but there was no indication the incident was a planned attack. Operations had just resumed after the area was struck by Iran earlier in the war. Tomorrow, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is set to travel to the Middle East to discuss the memorandum. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Liz Landers.
We now have two views on the U.S.-Iran negotiations and the agreement that ended the war. Moeen Robani is a former U.N. official and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. And Jonathan Karikas is a retired Israeli lieutenant colonel who led forces in Lebanon and Gaza and served as the IDF's international spokesperson. He's now a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks very much. Welcome, both of you, to the NewsHour. Moeen Robani, let me start with you, and let me start with today's news that came out of Vice President Vance, that it was lifting sanctions on Iran, selling oil for 60 days. What's your response to that announcement?
Well, I think this is an indication that the memorandum of understanding is beginning to produce serious negotiations between the United States and Iran. I think we have to disabuse ourselves of the illusion that an agreement can be reached within the next 60 days, but at least it could set the basis for constructive diplomacy and create this the space and the additional time that will be required to reach an agreement ultimately between the U.S. and Iran. I think it's a positive and hopeful sign.
Jonathan Karikas, the U.S. lifting sanctions on Iran selling oil sets the basis for diplomacy. Do you agree?
No, and I think that history teaches us that paying bloodthirsty murderers and terrorists, whether they are of a country or just a terrorist organization, never ends well. When you pay terrorist money, they're usually emboldened, and I will not be surprised to see that the money that the Iranian regime will make out of this very, very generous American concession won't go for the benefit of the Iranian people. It'll go towards armament, weapons, trying to fund Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist organizations, and I don't think that much positive will come out of it.
Moeen Robani, the other major news from the U.S. today was the announcement of a mechanism of deconfliction. That's the phrase that J.D. Vance used for regional ceasefire, essentially, for the war in Lebanon. And the vice president gave an example. He said that a low-level Hezbollah operative, who, of course, has been fighting Israel, who was not following orders but fired a drone at Israel, and then Israel fired back. So is this a step in the right direction? And what do you think about Vance's characterization of the war?
Well, I think the establishment of a deconfliction cell regarding Lebanon is also a positive development, and it shows that we're making the transition from the general political statements that were included in the memorandum of understanding, that we're transitioning to serious, detailed, technical discussions and actual implementation. And the purpose of this deconfliction cell, you know, the unstated premise, is that Israel appears determined to continue and, where possible, to escalate its military aggression in Lebanon in order to both continue with its objectives in Lebanon and in order to seek to derail U.S.-Iranian diplomacy. And this is essentially the U.S. and Iran together putting the shackles on Israel and preventing it from carrying out those intentions and those plans.
Jonathan Karikas, is Israel trying to derail this diplomacy?
I think what Israel is trying to do is to defend itself and live in peace in its internationally recognized borders without the attack of Iranian proxies, Hezbollah being the most dangerous and best armed one. Hezbollah is now in trouble, and that's why their masters, the Iranian regime, they're rushing to defend and try to save Hezbollah. And that is what this is about. This is not about the territorial sovereignty of Lebanon. It's not about the Lebanese people. The Lebanese people, by the way, are represented by the Lebanese government. And the Lebanese government says very clearly that they don't want Hezbollah as an armed foreign entity in their country, and that Hezbollah doesn't have the legitimacy to fight against Israel. And communications was never a problem. There already is a mechanism. I've been part of it. I was a liaison officer to UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, and I was part of the mechanism that carried messages between Israel and the Lebanese armed forces. But the problem is that with an organization like Hezbollah, a jihadi organization that is sworn to destroy the state of Israel and kill as many Jews as they can, the problem was never how can we communicate. The problem is why do they exist on our northern border, and why has Iran been able to provide them with weapons and money as they have been for over so many years, and why is this now happening, and why is this connection being made between the Strait of Hormuz and Lebanon? I think the Lebanese people, Israelis, and many other people are going to regret if this is the way things go forward.
Moeen Rabbani, why do we need another mechanism? What difference can it make?
Well, look at what happened with the previous mechanism that was established in November 2024 as part of the ceasefire agreement that was reached then. It was thoroughly ineffective. Israel violated that ceasefire on a daily basis, killing hundreds of Lebanese, conducting assassinations in the heart of Beirut. And so the purpose of this new deconfliction cell, as it's called, is to find a more effective alternative that can actually restrain Israel this time around. You know, the question was just posed, why does Hezbollah even exist? Well, there's a very simple reason, and that is because in 1982, Israel conducted a failed campaign to destroy the PLO in Lebanon, in its invasion of Lebanon at that time. And that set the basis for the establishment and emergence of Hezbollah. It's certainly true that Hezbollah would like to see Israel dismantled. And it's equally true that Israel has an official policy of destroying Hezbollah. That's why it's been fighting in Lebanon and occupying a good part of Lebanese territory.
Jonathan Conricus, you're shaking your head just in the last minute that we have.
Yeah, let's remind our American viewers that Hezbollah is a U.S.-designated terror organization with buckets of American blood on their hands, let alone Israeli blood, and they are nothing of the like. Hezbollah are a proxy organization of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are foreign. They serve foreign interests, those of Iran. They do not represent Lebanon. And that's not me saying it. That is the democratically elected government in Lebanon that says so. And frankly, it makes me puzzled why the U.S. is conducting two parallel processes. One, the negotiations with the Islamic state of Iran regarding Hormuz and linking it with Lebanon, but then also parallel to that, trying to make peace between Israel and Lebanon. These two processes, these two tracks cannot work together. They are mutually undermining each other. And I really hope that the ones where the sovereign state of Israel speaking with the sovereign state of Lebanon without Iranian interference is the one that will prevail for the benefit of everybody in the region.
We'll have to leave it there. Moeen Rabbani, Jonathan Conricus, thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer resigned today, setting in motion a process to replace him that will produce the seventh prime minister in 10 years. Starmer came to office just 2 years ago atop a landslide victory, ousting the Conservative Party that had governed the United Kingdom for nearly 15 years. But dissatisfaction with his government grew quickly, leading to a mutiny within his own Labour Party, and now a single likely replacement. Romilly Weeks of ITV News reports.
It's become a painfully familiar bit of furniture, and it could only herald one thing. The lectern manoeuvred into position, the banks of cameras trained, as Britain's sixth prime minister since the Brexit referendum became the fifth to resign before their time was up. Keir Starmer first wanting to show it hadn't all been for nothing.
Look at what we've achieved in just 2 years.
Then, watched by those MPs still loyal, he faced the writing on the wall.
The question my party is asking now is whether I am best placed to lead us into the next general election. I have heard the answer of my parliamentary party to that question, and I accept that answer with good grace. Every decision I've taken has been about putting the country I love first. That is why I will resign as leader of the Labour Party.
He had wanted, he had intended to fight on, but 4 years after Boris Johnson said the same, Keir Starmer has also bowed to the inevitable, leaving in a way he can never have imagined when he walked victorious up this street just 2 years ago.
His guiding compass has been to put the country first and to ensure that this next stage and phase is as orderly as possible. That is the measure of the man.
You're one of those backing the Prime Minister right to the end. Will you now back Andy Burnham?
Oh, look, I've been loyal to every leader of the Labour Party and every Prime Minister. I've been loyal to this one. I will be loyal to the next.
As for the man who wants to be next, Andy Burnham, so-called King of the North, made an almost regal procession southwards, his train tracked from Manchester to Euston, where he dodged waiting crowds and sped off in a cab, arriving in Westminster to be sworn in.
We now come to Andy Burnham, member for Makerfield.
That clearly not the limit of his ambition.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty King Charles.
The question now whether there'll be any leadership contest at all. The Conservative leader called for speed.
But what are we waiting for? There are critical decisions that need to be made.
Posing with around 200 Labour MPs this afternoon, Andy Burnham was showing any potential rivals what they would have to beat, and showing Keir Starmer what he has lost, as the Prime Minister, comforted only by his wife, re-entered Number 10, his home, his job, for not much longer. Romley Weeks, ITV News.
In the day's other headlines, the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool here in Washington is set to undergo more repairs, just days ahead of America's 250th anniversary. That's according to President Trump, who has repeatedly claimed without evidence that vandals caused the algae blooms and peeling paint that have plagued the pool since its renovation. Here's Stephanie Tsai.
Green, murky water and floating chunks of paint. This is the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool, just weeks after a renovation project that has cost taxpayers millions of dollars and stirred up political controversy.
We had vandalism.
In the Oval Office today, President Trump repeated that vandals are to blame for the damage and said there's photo evidence.
We have a, I think, 290, 300-foot slit right through it, probably a box cutter or a knife of some kind.
Authorities say they've arrested at least five people and handed out citations to several others. Among those arrested, former U.S. Olympian David Hearn, who is facing a destruction of government property charge. He says he was just touching lining that was already floating in the water.
I don't think it's something that will stand up in court.
Sarah Bronin is a law professor at George Washington University who specializes in historic preservation and property law.
The kinds of activities that the passersby are accused of doing, again, dipping their hand into the water, merely touching some of the material that has fallen off of the bottom of the pool, are really not the kinds of activities that, at least based on my review of case law and understanding of the statute, have ever really been prosecuted.
It was in terrible shape. It was filthy, dirty.
The president unveiled plans to clean up and coat the pool's surface in what he called American flag blue earlier this year, estimating it would cost up to $2 million. Once water started flowing back in, records revealed nearly $15 million were awarded for the project to companies with only limited experience with federal contracts. Aerial images of the pool showed a transformation from deep blue to murky green in the days that followed, and lining peeling from the floor. The pool quickly became a spectacle. Drawing a handful of self-styled pro-algae demonstrators and many more frustrated taxpayers.
I want my money back after seeing this. I think that it was a huge waste of money to begin with, and I think our resources could be used a lot better elsewhere.
Crews have been working to remove the green goop with vacuum pumps and strainers.
It's called New Pond Syndrome.
Pool expert and YouTube personality Steve Goodale, better known as Swimming Pool Steve, says the algae is a typical occurrence for freshly filled ponds. But the damage to the surface indicates potential issues with the bond layer applied between the old and new finishes.
If you are deficient or insufficient with your surface preparation of the substrate before you apply this product, man, you are in for a bad time. And what would that look like if you were to see that? Well, it would basically look like it would start peeling off in sheets.
President Trump says the new repairs are set to begin immediately. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Also today, the Supreme Court reinstated a murder conviction in the case of Eitan Peetz, the 6-year-old boy who went missing in New York City in 1979. In a 6-3 decision, the justices reversed a lower court decision that overturned the conviction of Pedro Hernandez, who admitted to the crime and was convicted of kidnapping and murder. But Hernandez's lawyers have said his confession was due to a mental illness. Peetz vanished while walking to a Manhattan bus stop. His disappearance helped launch a movement to find missing children, and he was among the first to appear on milk cartons. Across the Midwest, a series of tornadoes claimed at least 3 lives, leaving homes in tatters and tens of thousands without power. Eyewitness footage caught the tornadoes tearing through fields and communities in Indiana and Illinois yesterday. In Sedgwick County, Kansas, a man was killed when his home was blown off its foundation. Meantime, out west... Firefighters are battling a massive wildfire near the town of Eureka, Utah. All 1,000 residents have been forced to evacuate. And parts of Sedona, Arizona were also evacuated as dozens of wildfires rage across the country, across the Southwest, under hot and dry conditions. In Colombia, a Trump-backed political outsider looks set to be the next country's next president, amid a broader wave of far-right candidates across Latin America winning elections. As of now, Abelardo de Espriella holds a razor-thin lead over his progressive opponent with nearly all the votes counted. The business owner and lawyer has never held office. Nicknamed the Tiger, de Espriella has promised to crack down on crime and ease business regulations. Last night, he claimed victory and pledged to govern for all Colombians.
For those who voted for me and for those who chose another candidate, there will be no winners or losers. There will be no reprisals, no persecution, because in a democracy, there are no irreconcilable enemies.
His opponent, Ivan Cepeda, called the count, unofficial and non-binding, and said he'll challenge the results. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, authorities say the number of confirmed Ebola cases is now more than 1,000, with at least 254 deaths. The virus has now spread to a third displacement camp in the east of the country, killing an 18-month-old girl. Health officials say about 100 people have recovered since the outbreak was declared last month, but they add that contact tracing remains a problem and the peak of the outbreak is still to come. Turning to the World Cup, Lionel Messi is now the all-time leading scorer in tournament history. Argentina's superstar overcame a missed penalty kick early on to score his 17th and 18th goals in his team's win over Austria. The defending champions now advance to the knockout rounds. One team still aiming to advance? Norway is looking to ride a wave of fan support, with supporters performing their Viking row in New York's Times Square. Norway takes the pitch against Senegal tonight. On Wall Street today, stocks ended mixed as big tech shares struggled. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added nearly 150 points. The NASDAQ dropped 350 points, or about 1.3%. The S&P 500 also ended lower. And the music industry lost a titan today. Clive Davis nurtured artists across nearly every major genre for more than half a century.
It was once said Clive Davis lived for 3.5 minutes of magic. From the debuts of Whitney Houston to Alicia Keys, he shaped and signed superstars. Bruce Springsteen, name-dropped by Aerosmith. Davis was himself a star, an unparalleled hitmaker. He rocketed to the top of the industry and stayed there for almost 70 years. Davis grew up in Brooklyn, the son of a traveling tie salesman.
Never knew I had ears, never knew that I could hear a hit record, never knew that I could discover an artist. But this is one of the lucky breaks that occur in life.
He got a scholarship to Harvard to become a lawyer and started in Columbia Records' legal department at the age of 28. He rose to become its president thanks to his, quote, golden ear, and struck gold, embracing the rock and roll revolution, signing artists including Janis Joplin.
I mean, it really raised the hair on your arms and sent those proverbial tingles up your spine. But there are epiphanies that could happen in life that change you. And this was an epiphany for me.
His career changed throughout, and at times he became a lightning rod. In the 1970s, Columbia Records fired him and accused him of stealing money. He was charged on a number of counts and indicted on tax evasion. He also clashed with some of his artists, but he always said his focus was the songs.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight.
Across genres and decades, he once said, I don't look for hit records, I look for stars. Billy Joel, revitalizing the career of Aretha Franklin. And embracing hip-hop and R&B.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine.
This was a golden era. It was a golden era for the music industry. It was certainly a golden era for me.
A music titan who helped provide the soundtrack of so many people's lives. Clive Davis was 94 years old.
Still to come on the NewsHour, a new Justice Department memo questions decades of protections for people with disabilities. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political headlines and the life and legacy of the late Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan.
This is the PBS NewsHour from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, headquarters of PBS News.
A recently released Justice Department memo questions decades of protections for Americans with disabilities. It's the latest effort by the Trump administration to shift longstanding practices for the disability community. Ali Rogan has more on potentially landmark changes.
Nick, the new memo is one of several attempts to change services and policies dedicated to people with disabilities. The DOJ says states aren't required to provide home and community-based services that have long kept disabled Americans out of institutions if they would benefit from these other services. And as the administration seeks to shutter the Department of Education, it's moving key responsibilities to agencies which disability advocates say are less equipped to handle them. For perspective on what these actions mean for the disability community, I'm joined by Maria Towne. She's president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Maria, you are on the move today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I first want to ask about this DOJ memo, which really provides a new interpretation of these existing laws and a Supreme Court decision that reaffirmed what we have understood to this point to be the rights afforded to people with disabilities. Can you just walk us through what those existing statutes are?
So in the Americans with Disabilities Act, which turns 36 next month, there is an integration mandate. And the Olmstead decision is a Supreme Court decision that turns 27 years old today that affirmed the integration mandate in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The Olmstead decision stated that people with disabilities had to be served in the most integrated setting whenever possible. What this means in practice is that states cannot forcibly institutionalize people with disabilities, whether that be in nursing homes, state psychiatric facilities, or in other institutional settings. And so this memo from the Department of Justice, which says that Olmstead is not enforceable, completely goes against all previous legal precedent. And it also goes against the will of Congress and the will of the Supreme Court.
So if states no longer feel obligated because of this DOJ legal opinion, which we should mention is not a law, but could have far-reaching implications anyway, if states don't feel obligated to provide these services to people who would benefit from them rather than go into an institution, what does that mean for the people who rely on home and community-based services?
This means that people's ability to live in their homes and in their communities and with their families and friends that they love is in jeopardy. If states decide not to follow decades of legal precedent and existing civil rights, it means that people with disabilities may be forced into institutions instead of being provided with services that allow them to thrive in their communities. It may also mean that people's health suffers. And in the worst case scenario, it means people will die. We know that people with disabilities and older adults have better outcomes and live longer lives when they are served in the community and not in institutions. So this could have extremely dire consequences for many people and their families across the country.
Separately, Maria, the administration is taking steps to move oversight of special education from the Department of Education to HHS. Here is what Education Secretary Linda McMahon said recently about these changes. Quote, "By closely partnering with HHS, we will align federal services to improve academic outcomes, strengthen access to programs and information, and support people with disabilities so they can gain self-sufficiency, life tools, and meaningful employment that they need to succeed in their lives." How does your group see it?
This move basically re-medicalizes the education of students with disabilities. Putting special education in education asserts that students with disabilities have a chance at mainstream curriculum, at developing critical thinking skills, and in participating in the classroom, mainstream classrooms with their non-disabled peers. We see this as a resegregation of students with disabilities when literally for the past 50 years, the standard has been to serve students with disabilities in the least restrictive environment and to ensure that students with disabilities have a free and appropriate public education. We are concerned that the public education students with disabilities will receive will no longer be appropriate because it will no longer be a meaningful education.
And we see the government focusing on changes to policies and services that affect children and adults with disabilities. What are the stakes for the wider disability community here?
These changes, both the change in education coupled with the DOJ memo, basically put our nation back at least 50 years, if not more. We are worried that we will see the progress that's been made on disability rights and on the quality of life of disabled people, whether they're young or old, erode very, very quickly, and that hard-fought progress will be lost.
Maria Towne, President and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The war in Iran has opened new cracks in President Trump's relationship with GOP leaders on Capitol Hill. And Democrats face their own family feud this week as New York's primaries pit progressives against moderates. Here to reflect on that and the reflecting pool is our Politics Monday duo, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Thanks, guys. Welcome back.
Hello.
Tam, let me start with you. Got high-profile Republican allies questioning the Iran memo of understanding, say it's weak. And there's also spy power negotiations at a standstill. Is this a GOP conference now pushing back or not?
I think that we need to wait a little while to see whether they are rhetorically pushing back or whether they're actually going to take votes or do more substantive things to push back on the president. They certainly have, some of them have certainly expressed displeasure with the Iran deal, with President Trump like temporarily pulling his nomination for the director of national intelligence or telling him not to show up for his confirmation hearing. There is a big well of frustration with Republicans towards the president. There's a big well of frustration from the president towards Republicans, insisting that they do all kinds of things to pass the Save America Act,
right,
which is a measure that would require voter ID, proof of citizenship, and also would really limit mail voting, which a lot of Republicans actually like. He's putting a lot of pressure on Senate Republicans. Mm-hmm. He's actually headed up to the Hill this week to meet with some of these Senate Republicans. It's just not clear that they can give him what he wants, but it's also not clear how hard they're ultimately going to push back against him.
Hey, man, I wonder how much political pressure there is from people, so to speak. Let's look at the polls.
The people.
PBS NewsHour, NPR Marist poll released last week found the president with the lowest approval rating of his second term, 36%, only 33% approving of his handling of the economy, a new low for him as president, and 78% of Americans say gas prices are straining their household budget. How much of this is actual
pressure? Here's where this Republican rift is really interesting. As we've been discussing, and you know very well, there's definitely a rift ideologically on Capitol Hill between those maybe who are more hawkish, who would like to see the United States continue down the path they were going on militarily, and others who did not want to see that. But fundamentally, politically, if you're a Republican up for re-election in a tough district, here's a number you've been seeing since the war started. The president's handling of the economy, the net unfavorable, has gone up by about 10 points. His net unfavorable on inflation has gone up close to 20 points. That is a problem for you as a Republican running for re-election. So this war ending, theoretically, is going to help bring those numbers back to hopefully a reasonable place if you're a Republican running for re-election. But the challenge right now for Republicans, in the sort of intra-party challenge, beyond this question of how hard do they push back on Donald Trump, who still remains the kingmaker in the party, but is the lack of enthusiasm among the base. The one thing in that Marist poll that I looked at is people who identify as Republican, how strongly do they approve of Trump versus how many are just like, yeah, he's okay, he's fine, I approve. The strongly approved number since a year ago at this time among Republicans has dropped like close to 12 points on net. And so what you're seeing is Republicans aren't abandoning Donald Trump, but they're just not as enthusiastic about him, which means they may not be as enthusiastic to show up to vote.
Let's talk about Democratic primaries tomorrow. Maryland and Utah hold primaries tomorrow. South Carolina hold its primary runoff. But most election watchers will be focused on New York, where New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani is backing challengers against incumbent Democrats he sees as too moderate. Amy, which races are you watching most closely?
Well, let's start with this. Yes, it's New York. I love the people of New York, but it is a very small segment of the electorate. Now, no doubt, I think the national attention is going to be on Mamdani and whether he can use what he has right now, which is considerable political clout within the New York City, the progressive movement, to get his preferred candidates over the line. I'm intrigued by a couple of things. The first is, there's basically an AI versus AI battle taking place in one of the districts in Manhattan, Upper West, Upper East Side, where the folks from Anthropic, who would like to see maybe more regulation, are supporting a candidate who, while in the state legislature, actually passed some AI regulation. The folks at OpenAI don't really like the legislation that he passed. And so they're spending against him millions and millions of dollars for one seat in Congress. The second thing I would say, there's a lot of talk about whether Mamdani succeeds. What does this mean for the Democratic Socialist Movement? Does this mean the party now, the Democratic Party, has moved so far left? The race, I think, that's going to tell us much more about that is not happening until August, and that's in Michigan, where a much more progressive candidate, sort of in the mold of some of these candidates that Mamdani is supporting, is facing off against two more sort of establishment-y type of Democrats in a swing state, in a state that's going to matter in the next upcoming presidential election as well. So whether that candidate can win a primary and whether that candidate can win a general election will tell us a lot more about the strength of that wing of the party, the Mamdani wing or the Bernie wing, than what's happening in New York.
And Tam, let me finally get you on the pool. So the president seems...
Why, thank you.
The president seems increasingly frustrated, shall we say, by his struggle to clean the pool, to convince the public that it was, in fact, saboteurs who created all that algae and all of the paint crusting. Do these claims, do these arguments still land with his supporters?
Yeah, and I will not be here to truth on or fact check on epoxy and how it works, because that is not my expertise. What I will say is that this reflecting pool has turned into yet another fight over Donald Trump. And he made the pool about himself. It is one of many projects that he has pushed through ahead of America 250. He has put so much focus on it, so much, calling people into the Oval Office to show charts of the pool next to giant skyscrapers to say how big it is, and on and on and on, and all of these Truth Social posts and all of this, that he's drawing so much attention to it. And it does raise the question, like, what about those kitchen table issues that Senate Republicans want to talk about? And this housing bill that is bipartisan support and just passed the Senate that could be something that they could run on.
Or talk about, which he has not talked about at all, right?
Right. Yeah. Other than the pool. Yeah. Anything but the pool.
I have a feeling the pool debate will continue.
Yes. So,
Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Welcome, Nick.
Today, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, died from complications of Parkinson's at the age of 100. Greenspan was widely considered the most powerful chair in modern times, serving for nearly two decades and largely presiding over a period of long prosperity. He was frequently credited for helping manage inflation and foster growth, but his strong beliefs in the free market and less regulation came under sharp criticism during the financial crisis. Paul Solomon has our remembrance.
Alan Greenspan, born in New York City in 1926. He told Jim Lehrer in 2007 that he was a whiz with numbers from the beginning.
The math was a big deal when I was very young and my mother used to parade me out. She would have me add 45 and 162 in my head. Mm-hmm. And I'm a kid. And
you were just being kind of there as show-off boy,
show-off.
Right?
I was a prop for parties.
Yeah.
But Greenspan's first career was in music, studying at Juilliard and playing jazz professionally. It wasn't long, though, before he gave up gig work to go back to numbers.
The best economic decision I ever made in my life was to decide to leave the music business and go into economics.
Young economist Greenspan was soon drawn to Ayn Rand, fierce opponent of government regulation.
Each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
The author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged became Greenspan's mentor.
He was almost a quasi-son, I would say.
Sebastian Mallaby wrote a biography of Greenspan, The Man Who Knew.
His roots were in the extreme sort of libertarian anti-government circles. And it's remarkable, therefore, that he spent most of his career very successfully in power, in politics, in Washington, and doing all the things that a libertarian might abhor.
Greenspan got into politics as an advisor to the 1968 Richard Nixon campaign, chaired the Council of Economic Advisers under President Ford, was a member of President Ronald Reagan's Economic Policy Board.
Hi, Alan Greenspan.
Hi, Alan Greenspan.
And in 1987, he became chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Chairman Greenspan will bring all his skill to bear upon the task of promoting our continued economic growth while keeping inflation low.
He went on to serve five terms under four different presidents, trusted by Republicans and Democrats alike.
He just had this ability to go into a room in a one-on-one meeting, spout a bunch of very obscure data, and make the other person feel that the only way they could understand this stuff is they asked for his advice.
I'm trying to punch it out of my life.
Just 2 months after he became Fed chair, the stock market crashed by over 22% in one day. October 19th, 1987.
And he issued a statement saying that the Fed would do what it took, effectively, to stabilize the markets. And that was enough to get the markets to bounce back.
Whenever the stock market threatened to plunge again, says Mallaby,
Greenspan seemed to pop up say something which stabilized everybody's nerves, you know, offer maybe to cut interest rates, and then that would make the markets go up again.
Greenspan was credited with steering the Fed through two recessions. For stabilizing global markets in the late 90s, he was lionized and praised for intervening again after September 11th. And in fact, Greenspan's reign coincided with the longest economic expansion in U.S. history, prompting the title Maestro of the U.S. Economy.
He really was, in a way that I think it's hard to imagine today, a sort of technocrat hero.
In one widely noted speech, Greenspan worried openly about the stock market overheating.
How do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values, which then become subject to unexpected and prolonged contractions?
But more typically, he kept markets up, though using opaque language to explain himself, especially when asked a question he didn't want to answer.
And so he would let his sentence sort of go around with multiple subclauses, and it would just be incomprehensible. It was a tactic and a very successful one.
No wonder his testimony before Congress could be hard to follow.
We at the Federal Reserve, recognizing the powerful forces of productivity growth and global restraint on inflation, have not perceived to date the need to tighten policy in response to strong demand beyond what has occurred through falling inflation's upward pressure on the real federal funds rate and the modest increase in the nominal rate.
As Greenspan later told Jim Lehrer,
one of the problems that surprised me when I got into public life was that open, clear talk often creates problems.
In 2007, there were serious worries about a financial bubble. Greenspan's response?
When you get bubbles like this, there is no way of diffusing them until the speculative fever breaks on its own.
Soon after came the 2008 financial collapse, and Greenspan's reputation quickly reversed. He was widely criticized for having allowed the housing bubble.
You know, financial bubbles are super disruptive, and to ignore them is a big mistake. And Greenspan made that mistake, and that is where I fault him.
But when he appeared before a House committee in 2008, Greenspan sort of admitted that he'd put too much trust in markets to self-correct.
Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief.
For much of his tenure, Greenspan presided over a rapidly changing economy, one transformed by technology and globalization, but it was all part of a business he never tired of.
I've been an economist since the latter part of the 1940s, and that's my profession. I love it.
Alan Greenspan is survived by his wife of 29 years, journalist Andrea Mitchell. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
Finally from us, melting ice. The world's glaciers are receding at an alarming rate, losing more than a trillion tons of ice a year. It's fueled in part by climate change and is driving sea levels higher, which could threaten coastal communities around the world. Special correspondent Ben Tracy of Climate Central found a man who, alongside his family, has seen the melt firsthand every year for nearly half a century.
But it is stunningly beautiful out here.
This one 2 miles we've done so far today. I mean, that was fun.
I'm not complaining. I'm happy to take a walk on a glacier any day.
In the rugged North Cascade Mountains of Washington State.
My life has been shaped by this ice.
No one likely knows this glacier better than Maury Pelto.
We got 6,000 measurements on this glacier.
You have 6,000 measurements on this one glacier?
Yeah, at least.
Wow.
For more than 40 years, Pelto, a glaciologist, has returned to this remote wilderness. The crunch of footsteps in the snow now rivaled by the sounds of melting ice.
It's always melting off. The crevasses are changing. We can hear the water flowing under our feet.
Yeah, I mean, just standing here, you can hear it just running under our feet.
Pelto founded the North Cascades Glacier Climate Project in 1984 as a grad student. He vowed to measure these glaciers every summer for 50 years.
So how deep is that?
This is 9.5 feet. So now we just do this over and over again all day long.
This is year 42.
How old were you when you decided to do 50 years of this?
I was 22.
22. How old are you now?
63.
In that time, the glaciers have changed more than he has, shrinking by 40%. Some have disappeared. Pelto's work has been featured by NASA and fed into a worldwide glacier database.
So of the 47 that you have studied and returned to over and over again, how many are gone?
12 of them.
12?
Yeah, and 9 of them just in the last 5 years.
Wow.
Climate scientists say warmer summers and drier winters, driven by our burning of fossil fuels, are accelerating the loss. 7 of the 10 worst years for glacier melt worldwide have happened since 2010, according to Climate Central. Or just ask Maury Pelto where the ice used to be.
Almost 50 feet above my head, just a decade ago.
A decade ago, this glacier would have been 50 feet above your head?
Yeah.
That much has been lost?
Yes.
Glaciers are Earth's water towers, storing 70% of the fresh water supply. Vital for drinking, farming, and the health of many ecosystems. As they melt, sea levels are rising and coastal flooding is getting worse.
We're on Ptarmigan Ridge, and that's a ridge that extends most of the way from Mount Shuckson to Mount Baker that we're looking at.
That is spectacular scenery up there.
It is. You know, it's the highest mountain in the North Cascades.
On his annual treks to Mount Baker,
it feels like home.
Pelto has hiked nearly 6,000 miles and slept 800 nights in a tent.
This is our kitchen. We got our living rooms. We got our picture window. It's also one of those places that's really special to us as a family.
I brought two real crampons and a fancy yak track.
His son, Ben, daughter, Jill.
Hi, oh, looking right at me.
And now his 9-month-old granddaughter, Wren, have joined him in the field.
2 feet.
2 feet.
Jill Pelto has spent 17 summers by her dad's side.
I get some measurements of the GPS along the blue ice.
But she doesn't just collect data. As the project's art director, she paints it.
So these measurements that you and your dad are taking out here, eventually some of those data points will go into your art.
Yes, exactly. Data is a story about something in the real world, and that story has meaning and emotion, and that's what I'm trying to bring into my art.
Her watercolor paintings are more than just beautiful landscapes. They reveal the science. Look closely and you see a bar graph of glacier decline in the North Cascades. One piece showing temperature rise and ice loss made the cover of Time magazine.
I think sometimes when people see data, there's kind of this instant reaction. And it's not like the data is any different in my art, but something about that combination maybe gets people to kind of put down that wall of like, oh, I can't understand this, or, you know, this is not something I'm interested in.
The average person is not going to read a scientific report.
No.
But they will see a painting.
Yes.
And it does impact you in a different way.
Yes, definitely.
Her art has given her dad a new way to share the story he's been recording for the past 42 years.
There's nothing left of the glacier that was around that cave.
No.
What has this been like for the two of you to do this together? I imagine something like this has to change your relationship in some way.
We do it so seamlessly at this point. Sometimes I don't know where I start.
Feels like you're one team out here.
Yeah.
This bigger project that just means so much to us and has shaped our lives. So sharing that every year is, beyond special.
Tomorrow we go to the Rainbow Glacier.
And now Maury Pelto has just 8 summers left to fulfill his 50-year promise.
What do you think it's going to be like that first year you don't come out here?
I don't know. I can't remember what it was like to not come out here. This landscape has been shaped by ice. And so to understand the landscape and the ice, you really have to walk across it.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Ben Tracy with Climate Central.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Nick Schifrin. I hope you had a good day. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thanks for joining us.